Just a minute ago, my sister sent me a text message that said my 3-year-old nephew is watching, so no pressure. I'm still kind of taking all that in. So, hi, Dante, and hi, family, where you are watching from San Francisco. Tis the season, thank you. This week I was flipping through my Instagram feed, like you do, and I came across the following inspirational post from my friend Danny. It said, with this beautiful graphic, "You should sit in meditation for 20 minutes a day unless you're too busy. Then you should sit for an hour." I double tapped the photo. This is good. I endorse this bit of religious wisdom, profound. And I immediately started dreaming, fantasizing really about how I could activate this hour of quiet reflection into my ridiculous December routine. And then my eyes moved down to the comments section, and another friend, Strawberries and Stardust, she gave Danny an emoji high 10. She liked the idea too. And then she wrote, "Would you mind babysitting my kid for an hour?" It was this great moment where the sublime came crashing into real life. Right? Like, what's a 24-hour mom to do when she wants an hour of quiet meditation, for example? Ancient religious wisdom meet real life. It's a bit like the way the warm fuzzies of Christmas come crashing into this holiday life we do in December, isn't it? You ever look at those precious moments, nativity scenes with its angelic porcelain figurines, or the fuzzy Christmas sweaters, ugly or not, and look at these things and wonder, what do these have to do with real life, especially real life in December? Like, have you been to LAX or the Tyler Mall this week? Yikes, there is nothing warm or fuzzy about it. I can testify. Or more poignantly, perhaps, have you seen the images coming from the German Christmas market? Or have you been reading tweets coming from Aleppo, Syria? Or have you heard the explosions from a fireworks store in Mexico or a warehouse in Oakland? Or did you sit here in this sanctuary just over a week ago at our Blue Christmas service and recognize the aches that we are carrying? With all that in mind, we could hardly be blamed if we listened to the Gospel of John that was just read and wondered, huh? I mean, we know for this month we've been going through the four Gospels and their stories of Christmas, but did we really have to align John with Christmas Eve? I mean, there's no Mary or Joseph, no wise men or shepherds, no story of pregnancies or refugees, no kings or even angels. If precious moments, nativity scenes, and fuzzy sweaters seem a little irrelevant to real life, well, John, I mean, this is literally poetry. Poetry about the Word. What? Now, it is good poetry. Most of us can agree. Good biblical poetry. And I want to suggest briefly this morning that if we listen carefully to John, I think there is more than just abstract, detached, theological warm fuzzies in his Christmas story. So remember, John is probably the latest of the Gospels to be written, maybe even as late as the turn of the second century AD. And for the beloved community of Jesus followers that John belongs to, this is a period of their lives that is marked by political anxiety and religious crisis, this community. So in the political sphere, the community has witnessed the hand of the Roman Empire coming down mightily as it massacred their Jewish brothers and sisters after an uprising. The temple is gone. Beloved Jerusalem is in ruins. They've witnessed all of this from Rome. And now the eye of the empire has turned towards these Christian communities during the reigns of Nero and Domitian especially. The charge against them is atheism, actually. Essentially, it's Rome questioning the Christians' patriotism toward the empire because they refuse to participate in the adoration of the emperor and all that Rome stands for. Atheism, unpatriotism. And then at the same time, in a complicated, almost ironic, triangulated mess, there is also religious anxiety for the community because tensions between the Christian followers of Jesus and the leaders of Jewish synagogues are building to a breaking point. The religious leaders have made pronouncements of heresy against these Jesus followers, and documents have been written up that bar them from participation in the very synagogues that they have lived in their entire life. These Christians in the time of John are unpatriotic heretics. They find themselves at home neither in the empire where they reside nor in their lifelong faith communities. What to do? They are facing what can surely be described as the darkness of turmoil and uncertainty. Furthermore, from the New Testament letters of John, we get hints that the effects of all of this crisis include tension and fighting within the beloved community. And some people are even abandoning ship altogether. What else would we expect in such a context? And so it's to this beloved and beleaguered community of Jesus' followers that John composes his gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. If Matthew in his Christmas story takes us back to Abraham, and if Luke in his takes us all the way back to Adam, son of God, John takes the story all the way back to the very beginning, when the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep. When all reality was a swirling chaos of nothingness, it is as if John recognizes that the bigger the crisis that is faced, the bigger the story of God that must be told. So John takes us back to the beginning where the primordial darkness is a swirling mass of all the darknesses that we will face in the world. And into this formless void, the Spirit of God enters, sweeping over the face of the deep. And God speaks into the darkness, "Let there be light." And there was light. It's that beginning that John points us to. And the Word, John says, was with God in that beginning. And all the good and beautiful creation that came into being through the Word. And this Word was life, a light to all people, John declares. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome. This is not poetry simply for poetry's sake, of course. This is poetry with a purpose. This is John reaching deep for words to encourage his community with the hope that even the darkest darkness cannot and will not overcome the light. This is John doubling down on the belief that the Creator, who knit together a good and beautiful world from the chaotic nothingness, this Creator will not give up on this world that God so loves, and this Creator will see to it that goodness and beauty are restored and the creation is healed. In fact, John is saying this is not just restoration and healing sort of in the grand sweep of history, but this is healing whenever the followers of Jesus follow his command to love one another. Whenever they lay down their life for a friend with the greatest love, their goodness and beauty are restored. The darkest darkness cannot and will not overcome such light. This is John's encouragement, and alongside this encouragement, John adds a pointed critique with a little bit of subversive rhetoric. This is John in his poetry. He also says, when light shows up, when grace and truth appear in the world, it will not be in the usual places that people look for saviors. In fact, the world didn't recognize the light when it came. Furthermore, the light came to his own people, says John, the insiders, the religious establishment, but John laments they didn't recognize or welcome it either. In fact, he continues, the children of God are not defined by their bloodline or their birthright. They're not established through lineage or the privileges of patriarchy or the entitlements of wealth and power and position. No, instead, John says, the children of God, they are anyone who extends welcome, anyone who offers hospitality to light. Anyone who believes that in steadfast love, costly love, and grace, as the way the world works best, they are the children of God. And an emphasis on anyone, John seems to say. For from the fullness of this word, the abundance, the overflowing of this word, we have all, not just a few, not just the privilege, all have received grace upon grace, upon grace, upon grace. These pointier words, these are John's encouragement to the community by way of critique. John subverts, pushes against the religious and political powers that seem to have the last word on the day, and in doing so, he lifts up the beloved and beleaguered community of Jesus followers. He lifts up the disparaged and the disillusioned. The light shines in the darkness, John says, and darkness cannot overcome. And finally, lest we are still tempted to think that John is content to be otherworldly and irrelevant to Christmas and to life, real life, there is this from John. The Word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. This is John's nativity scene. The Word became flesh, God became flesh and moved into the neighborhood, made his home with us. For John, this nativity scene of his, this poetic nativity scene, is anything but warm and fuzzy. For John, this is the Creator's world-altering, subversive resistance against the darkness. Against the darknesses, against the formless voids of nothingness, against principalities and powers, against hatred and violence. This is John's Christmas story. God made flesh. Yesterday, Becky's parents, who are staying with us this week for Christmas, they gave us a beautiful, beautiful gift. It is a creche, a nativity scene from Peru. There's Mary and Joseph. There's two shepherds, the pastorcitos. There's an ox and a lamb, maybe? And there's a baby Jesus with a little Peruvian blanket covering him. And as Becky's mom carefully unwrapped each piece and placed them on our table, I have to tell you, I was taken aback by the depth of my own emotional response to this beautiful nativity scene. My throat tightened, my eyes welled up, and to be honest, my urge was to just grab the whole thing, run off to my room, and weep. I know, it's a nativity scene. I'm not sure I'm able to articulate fully what touched me so deeply about this nativity scene, and maybe, by the way, that is the purpose of poetry and art, to be able to say what we cannot articulate ourselves. But I think I can describe a part of it, some of the thoughts that came along with the tears. First, as I look at these Quechua carvings from Peru, I'm reminded of the creche display that the stall center sets up every candlelight concert over in the Sierra Vista Chapel. Maybe you have seen this. That display is one of spectacular diversity. You have to see it if you haven't next year. And the diversity of that display may say more about the Christmas story than anything that I can put into words. See, this is a universal story we can tell when we look at that display. It's represented in just about every corner of the planet. And yet, while it is universal and far-reaching, the story gets enfleshed and incarnated in the particulars of each culture. So the baby Jesus is Peruvian and Mexican and Ukrainian and Korean and Kenyan and Syrian and Jewish and German and on and on. The universal Word of God, light and love and grace, becomes enfleshed in the everyday ordinariness of real life. The divine comes crashing into real life. That's Christmas. That's the gospel. That's our story. And secondly, maybe more pointedly, it appears to be the case to me that the places that you find the most vibrant traditions of carving these creches have a lot in common with the people of the Peruvian highlands. These are not exactly what you would describe as the places of privilege and power in the world. So for whatever reason, and I suspect there are some good ones, the peoples of the world cherish and connect with this nativity scene, with its baby born in a barn, its parents displaced from their home, its shepherds with a front row seat to an upside down inauguration. For the peoples of the world, the Christmas story is anything but irrelevant and detached and otherworldly. And if the story is good enough for them, it's good enough for me. But oh, that I have the ears to hear what they hear and the eyes to see what they see in this Christmas scene. So yeah, if this Christmas you want warm fuzzies, then get a sweater or get a peppermint mocha or maybe a Mariah Carey Christmas album. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. But this Christmas, if this Christmas you need deep down encouragement to face the formless voids, the chaoses of nothingness in your life, then look no further than the poetry of John. The Word, God, became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. And from the fullness, the abundance, the overflowing of this word, we all received grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. And if this Christmas you are searching, reaching for words to speak to darkness, if you find yourself longing for a way that together we can resist the powers of privilege and patriarchy, of apathy and cynicism, of hatred and violence and exclusion, then hear these hopeful, subversive poetry of John. the light, steadfast, costly love and grace, light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot, will not overcome. May we together be the people who welcome light wherever it appears. Amen.